This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Those of us shoveling out or shivering today may want to know that, on average, spring is likely to arrive early, a week, maybe a month early, depending on landscape, elevation, and altitude. But as heartening as that may sound, our early springs are symptoms of global climate change, according to author Gretel Ehrlich. The end of winter, she writes, could mean the end of life. To see what's happening, she traveled to the empty womb of a glacier in the Andes Mountains near the tip of South America and to the confluence of the Gulf Stream and the polar current near the Arctic archipelago of Spitsbergen. A woman who confesses to a love affair with winter, Gretel Ehrlich's new book is a visit to the front lines of what she describes as a war against the planet. Later in the program, the war that paused for a day or two as soldiers on both sides of the Western Front observed a Christmas truce 90 years ago. But first, a journey into cold. If you have questions or observations about the effects of climate change, or if you, too, treasure the mystery and power of winter, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Gretel Ehrlich joins us from Santa Barbara, California. Her new book is The Future of Ice, and it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us what you saw and experienced when you voyaged, to the ends of the earth, as you describe.
Well, I found, of course, a magnificently beautiful world everywhere I went. And I think it's the power of the natural world, the beauty of the natural world, especially cloaked in snow and ice, that actually makes me want to wake up and live fully every day. But it's also a melting world. And so I was always had a sort of bittersweet feeling of sadness and elation. Up in the north, the sea ice, the seasonal sea ice used to be 3 feet thick. Now, when it's 59 below zero, it's only 4 or 5 inches thick. That's happened in the last 5 years. At the bottom of the world, the glaciers are receding and or surging quickly. If they surge quickly, they calve off more quickly. And so whichever way they're going, they're disappearing. There's only meant to be about 160,000 glaciers left in the whole world. There used to be 350. I don't know exactly how many, but many, many, many more. We're losing our snow cover, we're losing our ice caps. These are the natural air conditioners of the world. They keep our climate relatively temperate, whether we're at the equator or near the top of the world. Without these, because ice and snow deflects solar radiation heat back into space. Without this, the Earth and the oceans become a heat sink. And we become hotter and hotter and hotter.
The hothouse, about the hothouse gases that we've heard of.
Yes, not only the gases, but industrial pollutions as well, industrial contaminants of all kinds. It turns out that snow and ice are excellent preservers of these. They kind of collect them, and when spring comes to the Arctic and the Antarctic, there's a chemical surge, which is very sad because it's a glorious time of the year there. And all the things that have flown around the world, I mean, it is truly a global phenomenon. Pollution from China, from Europe, from the U.S. Is accumulated in the precipitation. It rests during the winter, during the snow. It melts out into the streams and rivers and into the oceans that circulate all the way down to the bottom of the world and back up again. And so the pollution is, rivers are pollution highways, and snowdrifts are radioactive. It's quite a mess.
You travel to, down towards the Andes Mountains near the Beagle Channel in the southern tip of South America, as you mentioned, the Arctic seas up around Spitsbergen and the archipelago so far north. But these effects can be seen in this country. Glacier National Park, you say, has lost 75% of its glaciers.
Right. We'll have to rename it. I'm not sure what the name, Rocky National Park Or dry gulch is more like it. Yes, there will be no glaciers there in maybe 10 years.
And you spend part of your winters in northern Wyoming and make many descriptions of wonderful scenes there, but scenes where the climate just seems confused sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that's really the hallmark of a changing climate. People are have made too much of simply global warming. And so if it's we have a really bad winter somewhere, they say, well, see, there's no global warming. Well, climate change is very complex. And so we're the only thing that climatologists can say about it is that the weather, no matter whether it's hot, cold, raining, or snowing, is going to be more violent. And spring will come earlier, which creates even a 1 or 2 day shift, creates a shift all the way up through every bug, every bird, every animal, every plant. It makes an enormous shift through the whole ecosystem. And eventually, for example, the animals at the top of the world at high altitudes have nowhere to shift to. They're already at the top of the world or in the Arctic at the top of the weather extreme. And so they will become extinct first, and then we'll see extinctions all through the bird and animal life as one thing overtakes the other. Predator and prey relationships are changing. Insects will move higher up into the forest. Forests will die. Animals that depend, say, like on bamboo shoots or a certain kind of understory, will no longer find their usual food there, and they'll move somewhere else and push something else out. And the same will happen with humans as crop production starts to fail because of lack of water or too much water or terrible windstorms. Those human populations will shift somewhere else, pushing other people out. And so you can just imagine exponentially what the results are going to be.
Our number, if you'd like to join our conversation with Gretel Ehrlich about her new book, The Future of Ice, is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's bring on Stuart. Stuart's calling from Minneapolis.
Hi, Gretel.
Hi, Stuart.
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm good.
But we've got to get you down to the Antarctic.
Okay.
Yeah. I've been there many, many times, and the rapture of these extreme high latitudes is transcendent, and I think you know that. But I think Antarctica is the place where you feel more at the edge of everything earthly and probably more extraterrestrial. You know, if it wasn't for the oxygen, it would probably be we'd be spending space probes there. And I don't know what your deepest take on things are, but these cold, austere places, I find, are really fraught with numinousness. The transcendency of them is just places your soul in a very, very important place.
And that's really well said. And, and I think that people undervalue those experiences, whether they get to Antarctica or not, that we need to have places where our souls are renewed. We need to learn how to be brokenhearted again at the thought of losing such beauty, because if we don't, then we won't bother saving any of it.
Stuart, when are you heading back, or is this your summer vacation, a winter in...
Oh, man, I would hitch a ride today if I could do it, but I go through the National Science Foundations, and there are lots of hurdles and hoops to jump over and through. But I think the most climatological models are showing, even with the gross changes in the Arctic, the Antarctic has probably got a fairly reasonable life of 1,000 years before, really irremediable changes. But that's just a really geological blink in the eye of the eye. So it's happening everywhere, and there's one place that's going to take the longest, but as you say, it's drastic and it's absolutely heartbreaking.
Stuart, thanks for the call.
Sure, yeah.
Bye-bye. Let's get to Dennis on the line. Dennis is calling from Berrien Springs, Michigan.
Hello there.
Hello there.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you very much. I just have some comments and thoughts to make on the global warming. I guess it really is happening. I'm not questioning that. But as one thought, as I was growing up attending high school back in the 1950s, I was taught that we, the world, were on the tail end of an ice age, which I would interpret that as leading us to warming up globally. And my other thought on that, and then I'll take the answers off the air or comments, is that over the millions of years, areas that are now northern areas that experience a good winter used to be swampland where dinosaurs were and all that sort of thing. So there have been some dramatic temperature shifts. I just don't understand why we people and greenhouse effect are being blamed for what may well be just happening all over again like it did umpteen times for years.
Well, Gretel Ehrlich, you're not a scientist, but you've spoken to some for this book.
Yeah, sure. I mean, of course, there's great natural fluctuations in the weather, but because of the ice core drilling projects both in Greenland and Antarctica, we now have over 420,000 years of climate history at our fingertips. And the climatologists I talk to at the University of Alaska, the University of Maine, up in Spitsbergen, are charting these fluctuations on computers. And what they're finding now is an unfluctuating signal ever since the Industrial Revolution started, but particularly intense in the last 10 years. It just simply doesn't fluctuate. And so they are, I think, quite right in assuming that that's the result of our tailpipe and smokestack economies, that this non-fluctuating signal means that it's human-caused. There may be many variations in that as the natural fluctuations go up and down. Some people say we're at the end of an interglacial and should be headed into an ice age. There's many, many variables involved with this. The Earth's orbital cycles, fluctuation in solar radiation, what's happening with glaciers and how quickly they're melting off, what's happening with the Gulf Stream, which may go out of business here pretty soon. So there's many complexities, but I think there is really no doubt at all that greenhouse gases and industrial pollution are actually moving temperatures in one direction, and that's up.
Dennis, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We're spoiled, you write, because we've been living in an interglacial paradise for 20,000 years. Now we're losing it. Climate stability, not to mention human superiority and economic viability, are illusions we must give up. Illusions?
Well, I think, you know, in the sense that we think, you know, we've lived this incredibly sort of privileged life on the planet, especially in this country. So the illusion is that things are stable. Of course, everything is provisional. And because we are just live here a very short time, we assume that it's going to go on and on the way it has been. And that's simply not true. Rapid climate change events have been noted all through the history of weather, the history of weather that we have. And temperature shifts, sea salt concentrations, dust levels, they can affect climate very rapidly. And boy, it can just be a different world.
We're speaking with writer Gretel Ehrlich about her new book, The Future of Ice, A Journey into Cold. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Have you gone to the coldest places on Earth? Why? I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with writer Gretel Ehrlich. She's the author of a new book called The Future of Ice. What's your relationship with cold, ice, and snow? You're invited to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, TOTN, at npr.org. Let's get another listener on the line. And David is with us from San Francisco.
Hello there. I am a deep ecologist. I'm trapped in an air quality inspector's body at the moment. And I just wanted to let you know that on a personal level, I find that I need to talk to people in a way that doesn't overwhelm them as far as air quality, and I take it upon myself to hand out a very reader-friendly brochure on global warming and try to explain to people how air quality has an effect on global warming. And I'm wondering if you could address how other people, the listeners today, can do something on a personal level so they're not feeling overwhelmed by the huge problems that we're dealing with. We need to get people on an individual basis involved, and they can't do that unless they're given something that they can digest.
Gretel?
Well, I think everybody should educate themselves as easily as possible. I mean, you just have to go on the internet and type in climate change, and you'll get all sorts of information that's quite easily to easy to understand. And then I think, you know, we each have to look at our lives and sort of take stock of how we live and why the planet is important to us and the way in which we live on it.
Well, why don't I make changes. Why don't I phrase this another way? Why is it that so many people either don't seem to care or disagree with you?
I think that because people don't go outside enough, you know, they forget that they live on a living organism and that we're just part of a whole ecosystem, a whole within a whole within a whole, and that we need to change the way we make decisions about managing the planet. If we don't have a planet, we don't have life. You know, I think people have given up the great privilege of experiencing the natural world, to go shopping, to live indoors, to be busy. There's a wonderful Chinese character for the word busy, which means there's two characters. One means mind, the other means destroy. And in destroying our minds with our busyness, we're also happily destroying the planet. And I think we've got to kind of get a grip here. And you can't have life without a foothold.
Am I still on the air?
Mm-hmm.
I have another question. It sort of dovetails into this. What could, and this is kind of a rhetorical question, what could we say to the common listener who's living out there who isn't aware of...
We don't have common listeners, David. We have extraordinary listeners, each and every single one of them.
Excuse me. What could we tell the extraordinary listeners that they could do today? Could they call their air quality district, perhaps? Could they go online, as you say? What is something that they could get an immediate feedback on to feel that they are doing something? That's a rhetorical question. I'm just putting it out there.
All right.
Because
right.
I feel people would want to do something if they could feel that they would be heard and they knew where to go.
Okay, David, thanks very much for the idea. We appreciate
You're
the
welcome.
Phone call.
Bye-bye.
Let's get another listener on the line, and this will be Zachary. Zachary's calling from Kansas City.
Hi, folks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As a kid growing up in Kansas, we read all the Little House on the Prairie books by Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one of them, I think it's entitled The Big Winter or something like that, and it depicts this terrific winter storm that buried everything under snow. And I remember even as a kid, you know, there would be so the snow would be so bad on the prairie. I didn't grow up on the prairie, but I remember seeing on the news they would close I-70. People couldn't drive on the interstate because of the snow. And I have memories of a childhood filled with, you know, snowballs and snow forts and igloos and whatnot, snowmen. And the past few years, there just hasn't been snow to speak of in Kansas City.
And yet a white Christmas in southeastern Texas for the first time recorded.
Yeah. So yeah. I just thought I would call in to share my own experience of dwindling snow and ice.
Yeah, I think everybody's noticing that, which is good. we need to notice, and that the chaotic aspect is that there's snow in New Orleans yesterday and flooding in California today and no snow, you know, in the Rocky Mountain West where it should be. And so it's mixed up. I think also, you know, people have to realize that weather isn't something outside of ourselves, that it's not something that we should always be escaping from, that every breath we take is bringing weather into us, into our mind, circulating all through our brain and our body and leaking out of our pores. You know, we are part of the natural process. And, you know, the great biologist E.O. Wilson said that the human mind evolved within the matrix of nature. And the farther we get from that, the more we devolve, and that we're devolving.
Speaking of rhetorical questions, you ask, Zachary, by the way, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
You ask, when did we begin thinking that weather was something to be rescued from? You ask it in a rhetorical sense in your book, and maybe I'm being too literal, but the answer might be the moment the consciousness arrived and the next bad day after that.
Right. I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Well,
but
I'm just wondering why you're asking the question. You know, this idea of weather to be rescued from. Shelter is pretty basic to human existence.
Yeah, sure, shelter. But it's also, you know, wonderful. It's wonderful to go out into a storm. I mean, John Muir, the great naturalist, climbed to the top of a tree so he could really experience the force of a wind and rainstorm. You know, I think, of course, we need shelter, but also we need to go out into it and to understand it and to just play in it and experience it and get wet and get cold and get hot and, you know, just be a part of the basic fabric from which we evolved. Otherwise, we're fooling ourselves that we're somehow above, beyond it, that we have nothing to do with it, that, you know, our life will go on regardless of the weather. That's what I meant when I said we're living this illusion.
Let's get another caller in on the conversation. Beth is with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I'm so happy that Gretel Ehrlich is turning her talents to this subject. I think she's a wonderful writer, and I think of her as a poet. And anyway, I live in Cleveland, and we recently had a huge storm, and people were going out with their snowblowers and finding that the snow was so wet and so heavy that their machines weren't functioning, and they had to return to using a shovel. And so as I was listening to the comments just now, I was thinking that it has a lot to do with our experience of scale and the way that we solve our problems. And if we have machines that can solve problems for us, it takes the sense of scale away from us, and we no longer need to have that relationship with nature. And so my question was going to be, when I called, what suggestions you might have, Gretel, for what we can do, those of us who are concerned about this and realize that it's a real thing that we need to address.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody lives in a different place, but, you know, we could walk to the store instead of drive. We could, you know, carry our groceries in a backpack. We can grow gardens in the summer and plant trees. And we can, you know, assess the machines we use and say, okay, do we really need this? I mean, I think it goes back to the way we make decisions about our lives, that decisions, that biological health needs to come first. And when we assess biological, economic, cultural health all at the same time and say, okay, if I do this, will it affect the health of the planet? If I do this, will it affect my economic stability? And, you know, put all those little pieces together and look at, I mean, even in simple things like, you know, going to the grocery store or whatever it is in your daily life, just kind of step back and see why it is you're doing what you're doing, and if there's a better way to do it, to connect up with organic gardeners in your area and buy their produce, you know, get off the grid and use solar power, collect water in rainy areas. You know, there's just many, many things we can do.
I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but do you think the world is overpopulated by human beings?
Well, I would expect it is, yes. And, I mean, I'm not an authority on population, but of course, that's the population. I'm not sure whether it's appropriate to say it's overpopulated, but we do have this huge population, and so every weather event takes its toll, as we're seeing right now with the terrible earthquake and tsunamis in
obviously
Indonesia.
Not a weather event, but
not a yeah. It, well, it's a weather yeah. So, but it's a natural event that's impacting, you know, a very populated area of the world.
And as everybody says, because so many more people live so close to the seashore these days, its effects are wildly.
Exactly.
Yeah, much.
Yeah,
greater.
And, you know, if the sea levels rise as a result of global warming, it's predicted that at least 46 million people will be affected, you know, directly. You know, in Egypt, the Netherlands, Bangladesh, of course, the Pacific Islands, the perimeters of all the countries, you know. So, you know, we have big problems. But instead of saying blaming one thing and say, oh, you know, we're sort of lost, I think we have to learn to solve problems in a more inclusive way. Say, okay, we have this population. I mean, I was talking to George Schaller, also a wonderful biologist, the other day, and he said, I used to worry about overpopulation. Now I worry about greed. I think greed is what's going to bring us down. And so, you know, maybe we need to look at how we are behaving in the world and to make different decisions about how to live and how to live with each other. And, you know, balancing environmental decisions has to be done with the population and the needs of developing countries. We can't just say, you know, we're going to do away with people here when people are living off the land at the margins of national parks, et cetera. We have to consider all sentient beings and solve the problems accordingly.
We're speaking with Gretel Ehrlich, the writer and poet. Her newest book is The Future of Ice, A Journey into Cold. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Sean. Sean's calling from Paradise, California.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I want to ask Gretel, I'm an archaeologist that works in the Great Basin, mainly. She's been to Wyoming, so the southern end of Wyoming is the Great Basin. Is she aware of the climatology changes that existed there roughly like 4,800 years ago to roughly 10 to 12,800 years ago? 4,800 years ago, we had a 400-year drought within the area that spans Lake Tahoe east to Utah and north to Wyoming. That was 4,800 years ago. Now, this is before the Industrial Age. So what I'm asking Gretel is this. Does she see the Industrial Age as the whole consideration for climate change, or does she see it as an enhancement force as regard to climate change and cyclic variation that's natural anyways? And is she aware of these climate changes in the West,
okay,
you know, as they existed? We studied the tree rings at Lake Tahoe.
Sean, I think if you just give her a chance to respond.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting information. Of course, there's huge natural fluctuations in the weather ongoing. 130,000 years ago, it was hotter than it is now. And I know there's been very, very long droughts, and perhaps that's what we're in now. But the climatologists say when they map all this on their computer models that there is this unfluctuating signal. There is just no oscillation in the warming trends that we've been experiencing, especially in the last 10 years.
And you write about a lot other than Wyoming. The Arctic, you say, is a canary giving warnings about the health of the planet. Its ills are a symptom that points to root causes of every ecosystem's illness.
Exactly. And I've been living in and traveling by dog sled on seasonal sea ice in northwestern Greenland since 1993, when I first went. The sea ice in the winter and even all the way up through May was at least 3 feet thick. It is now in the middle of winter when it was, I was just there in March, 59 below zero, it was 5 inches thick. And the Inuit hunters, these are guys who live on the ice, have, you know, for 5,000 years, they have a sense of what has been going on with it. They say they've seen nothing like this. So I sort of came to this book from an experiential point of view. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen it. I see what's happening. You know, it will take a lot longer for people in temperate climates to feel these effects, but they're coming.
Winter can be beautiful, but also very harsh. As someone who has spent that much time, as you say, in Greenland and then repair to sunny, warm northern Wyoming in the wintertime, what do you find so beautiful about it?
That's such a hard question to answer. You know, it's sort of, it's like a big blanket that it seems like a form of embrace. You know, that the world quiets down, the world slows down. There's very little activity, but whatever is moving is very noticeable. You know, a moose munching on willows, a raven flying across the sky cawing, panes of ice moving and shifting in a big river. Birds leaving, birds returning. It sort of speaks of a state of mind, a kind of clarity that I aspire to. And it creates space, a kind of psychological space, a physical space in which the imagination can really germinate. And it's just a really magical time.
Gretel Ehrlich, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Gretel Ehrlich is a writer and poet. Her most recent book is The Future of Ice, A Journey into Cold. She joined us from Santa Barbara, California. When we come back from a short break, we'll remember a Christmas truce that suspended fighting for a day, two, sometimes longer, on the battlefields of Flanders in Belgium 90 years ago. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.